This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Jazz and swing fans in Wisconsin may be familiar with Maggie Delaney Potthoff. She's been a singer in the Madison-based band she and her husband formed more than 30 years ago, Harmonious Whale. But now she's a national superstar. More than 1,700 people from across the country entered the 2020 AARP Superstar Singing Contest. In the end, only Maggie gets to wear the crown. For the finals, she sang a rendition of My Favorite Things from the musical The Sound of Music. Here's a little listen.
Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes. Snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes. Silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad.
In addition to superstar status, Maggie gets $5,000 in prize money. Maggie Delaney Potthoff joins us now. Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's great to be here today. Thank you.
First of all, congratulations. I know it's been a few days since you found out you won. How does that feel, getting this national recognition?
Well, I'm still celebrating. We've had a lot of champagne flowing through our household. And Harmonious Whale put on a great sort of reception concert for us last Friday night. And I was very appreciative of that. So, yeah, we're still bubbling along.
I understand it was almost a last-minute effort for you to enter. What happened?
It was last minute. I was given a nice email early in June from a Harmonious Whale fan. A fellow lives right here in Madison. And he sent us saying, you know, I think Maggie should go for this. And I just let it sit in my inbox for almost the whole summer. And one night right before I turned in, I thought, what about that singing contest? I should really check that out. So I went and looked at my, search for that email. And boom, that deadline was in a half an hour. So I was like, oh, my gosh. So I threw on a red dress, stood in front of my piano. You have a two-minute submission that you can present to AARP. And I timed it out just right. And a few days later, found out I was in the top 10 finalists.
Now, because of the pandemic, this was online only. Normally, I guess in the big event, there'd be a full auditorium with a big band. Did that make it kind of weird just singing at home in front of a camera?
It's really weird singing in front of a camera. And, you know, now that it's over with, it's past, to tell you the truth, I just wrote to the coordinator today and I said, is there a chance that I could have a Zoom green room with the other top finalists? Because we would have met each other, we would have hung out, we would have shared our experiences. What are you doing with your singing? And that would have been fantastic. So I'll see if that unfolds for us, but I sure would love to meet them in person.
Talking to Maggie,
or at least on Zoom.
Talking to Maggie Delaney Potthoff from the Wisconsin band Harmonious Whale. She is the winner of the 2020 AARP Superstar Singing Contest. Maggie, no secret, this has been a tough and weird year. A lot of people, I think, turning to music in any form we can find it, even if we can't go see an actual show. Can you talk about what music means to you, especially in tough times?
Well, music to me is a very, very healing vibration, especially singing. You know, singing, the voice is the ultimate instrument, let's face it. And it raises our vibrations. When we use our voice to either speak or sing, we are using our whole body, our thinking brain, our spirit, our soul, our emotions all at once. There's no other instrument that does that. So myself, I love to use my voice not only as a lyric singer, but also as an instrumental singer. I love to use my voice to sing instrumental lines. And when I put that out there and I feel the happiness that other people receive through the music, then we know that it's the magic of music that's lifting people's spirits, helping them feel a little bit better when times are down. And I think there's just no doubt about it that music, it's magic.
Now, have you found ways to perform even this tough time where, you know, I definitely miss going into a bar and playing for, you know, the people that my band usually outnumbers. Have you found ways, though, to keep that performing bug going?
Oh, we really have. You know, when March hit and our calendar just went, boom, get the eraser. We missed out Summerfest. We missed Scotland, Ireland tours. And our own festival that we run, Midwest Gypsy Swing Festival, runs in September. What are we going to do? And so immediately in March, we set up the cell phone in our living room and brought our bass player into the house. And these was the very early coronavirus times. And we were very nervous to be all together, closely standing together in our living room. And we sang into our cell phone and we started our first quarantine-y concert. And Harmonious Whale has been running those religiously every Friday night. We move them outside. Now they're quarantini concerts under the oak. That's what they're called. They're online at harmoniouswhale.com or our Facebook page. And so many people have said, oh, this is the highlight of my week. You know, I'm ready for it. You know, I order my fish fry, I get my takeout, and I watch the virtual live performance or the live stream of Harmonious Whale on Friday nights at 7. And we're going to keep it going.
Can you offer some encouragement for everybody out there to maybe try to take some time to not just watch some music, but to perform, even if it's just singing in their own shower and embrace that healing power of music?
Oh, absolutely. I used to tell my kids, hey, sing every day and you'll never get sick. So, you know, just find yourself bringing yourself a little bit closer to that old record collection or your old CDs, or get yourself out onto Spotify, Pandora, listen to some music, hum a little tune while you're hanging the laundry, and you're going to feel better. I guarantee it. It's no doubt.
Maggie, thanks so much for joining us. And again, congratulations.
It's been my pleasure. Talk to you again sometime.
Maggie Delaney Potthoff is a singer in the Madison-based band Harmonious Whale. We talked with her about winning this year's AARP Superstar Singing Contest. You can hear more of Maggie's singing at the band's website, harmoniouswhale.com. That's W-A-I-L, harmoniouswhale.com. Coming up, it's been 50 years since the Apostle Islands were designated as a national lakeshore. We'll talk to a park historian about the push to make that happen and the natural and human history of the islands. That's coming up next on Central Time. Now, the Apostle Islands off the northern tip of Wisconsin are celebrating 50 years since being designated as a national lakeshore. This Saturday marks the anniversary of the congressional act that made the area a protected park in 1970. It came after years of advocacy from Wisconsinites and thousands of years of people recognizing the islands as a special and, in some cases, sacred place. Bob Macreth is a retired park ranger at the Apostle Island National Lakeshore and a park historian. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Happy to be here.
Well, Bob, I think I and a lot of people, when we think of the Apostle Islands, we think about the nature and the wildlife, but there's a long human heritage, too, that's making the island special. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, just as a start, I'd like to point out that every one of those islands, down to the very smallest one, at some point in history was someone's home or workplace, and it might have been a farmer or a fisherman and their family, or loggers or the workers at the brownstone quarries and their families. But one point or another, every one of those islands was somebody's home or workplace. And you know what I like to tell visitors when they go out to the islands is, you know, there are only so many suitable landing places and clearings on any given island, so that when you beach your kayak or pitch your tent, it's guaranteed that you're going to be doing it at a spot that looked like a good campsite to many other people over the centuries. And all the way back in 1840, a geologist who was surveying the island said, we frequently select spots that have been the campsites of voyageurs and Indians from time immemorial. So when you settle down for the night in your tent, what I tell people is just listen closely and use your imagination, and you may hear voices out there, and they may or may not be speaking English. They might be speaking Ojibwe or French or Norwegian, but use your imagination and you'll hear them.
Now talk about the drive to create these federal protections for the Apostle Islands.
Well, the actual history of it goes quite a ways back. There was talk about protecting the islands as some sort of park or preserve all the way back into the 1890s. Scattered comments here and there, but there was a real big push in the late 1920s. And in 1930, a group of local promoters persuaded the National Park Service to send a representative here to northern Wisconsin to look the islands over for possible inclusion in the national park system. And the representative came out here, and they wined and dined him, and they took him out to the islands. They hired a newfangled airplane to take him over the islands and did their best to show off the place. And unfortunately, this was right at the close of the great logging era, and the landscape that this fellow saw basically colored his judgment and what he wrote back to Washington was a far more striking landscape has been obliterated by the axe followed by fire. The hand of man has mercilessly destroyed the island's virgin beauty, and the project does not meet National Park Service standards. Well, that was very poetic, but it's also quite wrong. And 40 years later, it was proven wrong to the point that it became a national park area, an area within the national park system, specifically Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. And this was largely through the efforts of Gaylord Nelson, who governor and then senator. And, of course, Nelson, in my mind, is one of the giants of the environmental movement here in Wisconsin. He's standing shoulder to shoulder with John Muir and Aldo Leopold as far as Wisconsin conservation heroes. And he already had an idea that he wanted to do something to preserve the islands when he was governor. He ran on a conservation platform, and protection of the islands in one way or the other was part of his plan. But when he became a senator in 1962, he was in a really good position to turn the dream into reality. But even so, it took 8 years of wheeling and dealing and maneuvering by a master politician to get that dream turned into an actual national park, which took place, as you mentioned, in 1970.
Before we run out of time, I want to check out some newer news here. Shaw Point recently added to the National Register of Historic Places. Can you tell us about Shaw Point?
Well, that's correct. Shaw Point is on Sand Island, and out of the 22 islands of the generally considered the Apostles, 21 are in the national park. One of them is not, and that's Magdalen Island, which, as most people know about, is having a village out there. But there's another island that had a full-time, year-round settlement on it, and that's within the national park, Sand Island, at the western edge of the archipelago. And Sand Island had a full-time, year-round community for about 50 years, roughly from the 1890s to the time of the Second World War. And now, if you go out to Sand Island, it's almost like, you know, in places going to a ghost town, because when you walk through the woods, you turn up the remains of old farmsteads and fish camps. But down at the south end is a small settlement, which is what's left standing, basically, of the original settlement out there on Sand Island. It's basically occupied by the descendants of the original islanders, the farmers and the fishermen, and some of the very earliest summer residents whose roots go back a century virtually for all of them, and some of them for considerably more than that. So just this year, finally, after a seven-year project, the area at the southern end of Sand Island, this settlement of roughly 30 acres and 32 buildings, has been designated as a officially recognized National Historic District within the National Lakeshore. And it provides protection, additional protection of the structures, and recognizes the historic significance of that settlement. And it was a wonderful example of a partnership between the National Park Service and a nonprofit group, which I work with, the Apostle Islands Historic Preservation Conservancy, which is formed around a nucleus of some of the historic island families. So it's a way in which the
And we'll have to leave it there.
Families.
Thanks to our guest, Bob McGrath, a retired park ranger and historian, talking about how the Apostle Islands became a national lakeshore 50 years ago this weekend, sharing some of the history of the Apostle Islands with us. Remember, you can support great conversations with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 during our fall member drive. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Wisconsin Public Radio and Central Time. Stay tuned. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This year feels like no other year in recent memory, from the COVID-19 pandemic, the economic crisis, a tense election cycle, and ongoing protests against racial injustice. 2020 feels like an unusually unsettled year. And while 2020 may have people feeling like the country is at a low point, our next guest says we could potentially be at a turning point with change, maybe for the better, if there's enough momentum to act from political leaders to everyday people. George Packer is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His latest piece is titled America's Plastic Hour is Upon Us. George, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Will you borrow this idea of a plastic hour for your piece? Tell us what that means.
It comes from the Jewish philosopher Gershom Scholem, and he used the phrase to mean a moment when, after a long period of stasis, suddenly things become possible. You can actually change society, you can change politics, you can move things forward that have been stuck, but it all depends on the timing and on actually realizing the moments at hand and moving. And I think that's a good description of the moment that we're in right now, a moment when things suddenly are possible that we're not seeing. Things are even perhaps inevitable, if not likely, that seemed impossible just a year ago or so.
You say it's possible that this could lead to good changes, but not necessarily inevitable. What kind of things, and we'll get into what kind of changes you're looking for, but what kind of things would it take to take this plastic hour and make it a change for the good?
Well, to be blunt about it, the first thing that has to happen is that the election needs to sweep out Donald Trump and the Republican majority in the Senate. Without those two things, I think we will have more of what we've seen the last few years, division, bitterness, obstruction and stagnation in Congress, and problems that go untreated and unsolved year after year, whether it's economic inequality or racial inequality or climate change, decaying infrastructure, all the things that we all know about but that seem never to get dealt with because of the profound divisions in the country. Those divisions will continue regardless of who wins the election. But I think a Democratic majority in the Senate and a Biden presidency would realign the stars in favor of legislation that could actually get us out of the rut we're in and start to see change in a constructive direction.
Talk about some of the changes you would hope to see in that scenario.
I think to be general about it, government needs to take an active role in helping Americans solve the fundamental problems of their lives. That means in healthcare, where instead of chipping away at a public-private system that was put in place by Obamacare until fewer and fewer people are covered by health insurance in the middle of a pandemic. Instead, what Biden wants to do is create a public option so that Medicare could be available to those who don't have insurance and who want it. And that would just give people the security that they can get sick, they can get the coronavirus or some other terrible disease and not be destroyed, not be ruined by it. I think Biden is proposing a lot of spending on job creation, especially manufacturing. He has a pretty sweeping program that he's proposed to spend on supporting American-made manufacturing to bring companies back that have gone overseas with a bunch of tax incentives and disincentives. To spend money on raising the pay and status of the caregiving jobs like elderly care, child care, teachers, which we've realized during the pandemic are essential workers. So I could go on and on. There's a lot more in his program, but those are policy solutions that Biden has proposed that I think address some of the key crises that have been revealed by this pandemic. Both a social safety net that's full of holes that people are falling through, a decaying manufacturing sector that Trump promised to revive and did not, and support for workers who are caught between, you know, unreliable schedules and no paid sick leave and no family or medical leave and low wages that are stuck well below, you know, the rate of inflation and inability to form unions. All of those things are worker focused, and Biden has really made workers kind of the heart of his economic program.
Now, Republican listening,
that answers things that I think the coronavirus has exposed as flaws.
A Republican listening might say, wait, hold on, you just want to have a divided society with Democrats on top. Republicans have their strategies. We might disagree on the best roads to improve the country. What would you say to them to say, hey, wait, you're not just, you know, making a Democratic partisan argument that's leaving Republicans out of the solution?
I'd say if the Republican Party is going to continue to be a party that really is based in minority rule, and uses undemocratic tactics like voter suppression in order to stay in power and isn't interested in government as a positive force in people's lives, then you're absolutely right. I can't imagine progress in these areas without a strong government and without a strong citizenry that can vote and that can make their voices heard. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. This is not a nonpartisan, let's all come together and set our differences aside vision. I don't think that's possible right now. We're too divided. But I do think that power needs to shift from a party that has placed its bets on a shrinking minority of voters and done so, and you in Wisconsin know all about this, done so through undemocratic means like taking power away from the governor immediately after he's elected, having a legislature that doesn't reflect the makeup of the state population, and by gerrymandering and all sorts of other tactics that have entrenched minority rule. I think that is something that has kept us in this rut, and it needs to be changed.
Talking to George Packer, staff writer for The Atlantic. His latest piece is titled America's Plastic Hour is Upon Us. George, you make the case in your piece that while on the surface we've got a lot of partisan divides, you say that a lot of polls suggest that there's a lot that we agree with kind of beneath the surface. Where do you see that?
I think on cultural issues, there are deep divisions. So, for example, abortion, it's an insuperable divide. The different positions are entrenched. And so, for example, if the last weeks of this election become a debate over abortion rights and the Supreme Court, I certainly don't think that benefits Biden. I don't know if it benefits Trump, but it simply intensifies those cultural divisions on issues like that. But on economic issues, whether it's taxing the very wealthy, whether it's raising the minimum wage, whether it's giving workers more protections on the job, there's a pretty strong majority for most of those positions. And I think it's when politicians shift to the culture wars that they distract the public from policies that are actually quite popular, having to do with essentially increasing economic equality by giving workers more power and more rights. And that's where I think Biden has focused, and I think he's right to focus on that rather than on hot button cultural issues that just lead to more division.
George, I've heard from a couple of authors and others lately making the case that on those economic issues, a lot of Americans feel abandoned by both parties, a sense that Democrats turned from the interests of the working people to the financial sector in particular. Do you see room for both parties to do more to meet concrete needs of working people in those ways?
I think that those views you're hearing are absolutely right. The Democrats don't have a whole lot to say for themselves where this is concerned either. And I think that's directly related to the incredibly corrosive role of money in Congress and in politics generally. Ordinary people just don't have a voice in Washington because they don't have the money to have a voice. And that has to do with both laws and with Supreme Court rulings that have read the Constitution to give corporations to say the corporations are the equivalent of persons, and to give them all the rights that people have in terms of campaign contribution. So I think what you're getting to is the other part of my essay, not just the economic questions, but the questions of citizenship. People feel that respond to them, that it's far away, it serves its own interests, it doesn't hear them, that they're not represented in legislatures or in public arguments, that the media don't hear them, that social media are just full of loud, poisonous voices. And I think there are a lot of changes that could come along with the policy changes that would give citizens more of a say in their government. And that could go either way. That might lead to more conservative outcomes or more liberal outcomes. But I think it's essential that we revitalize our democracy, because without that, no agenda, not even what I think is a strong economic agenda like Biden's, is going to really counteract the cynicism and the disenchantment that's so common now in our politics.
In our last couple of minutes, I think there's a lot of fear out there, George, that the wheels are about to come off of the American system of representative government and how we elect people. Accusations from the president himself about the unreliability of the American election. You paint a positive picture of the way things could go. Do you share some of those fears, though, along the way?
I think the next 2 months, 3 months are going to be unlike anything we've lived in our lifetime. Just as this year has been more tumultuous and tragic than any year that I can remember. But I think in the end, if people believe in our system and believe in the integrity of our elections, that there will be fraud in very small, almost microscopic quantities on the margins, but that the elections are basically sound and that our local election officials take their duties seriously, then I don't think there's much that any politician can do to destroy the system. It's really up to the people's belief in our democracy. And the danger is that politicians can undermine that belief with what they say and what they do. And we're seeing that on a daily basis. Just yesterday, the president said he might not be able to promise that he'll respect a nonviolent transition. I've never heard anything like that from a president. That sounds like something from a banana republic. So as long as people believe in our democracy and act on that belief by voting and by being good citizens and watchful citizens, I don't think that a politician by him or herself can destroy it. I think it takes the people to destroy it.
George, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Hope to do it again.
George Packer is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He talked to us today about his latest piece titled America's Plastic Hour is Upon Us, which looks at how 2020 could bring about long-term societal change.